Alice spent the earliest part of Christmas Eve morning on the couch, sipping tea and browsing through photo albums. Over the years, she had transferred any newly developed pictures to the next available slots beneath the clear plastic sleeves. Her diligence had preserved their chronology, but she'd labeled nothing. It didn't matter. She still knew it all cold. Lydia, age 2, Tom, age 6, and Anna, 7, at Harding's Beach in June of their first summer at the Cape House. Anna at a youth soccer game on Pocosset Field. She and John on 7 Mile Beach on Grand Cayman Island. Not only could she place the ages and setting in each snapshot, but she could also elaborate in great detail on most of them. Each print prompted other unphotographed memories from that day, of who else had been there, and of the larger context of her life at the time that the image was captured. Lydia in her itchy powder blue costume at her first dance recital. That was pre-tenure. Anna was in junior high school and in braces. Tom was lovesick over a girl on his baseball team, and John lived in Bethesda on sabbatical for the year. The only ones she had any real trouble with were the baby pictures of Anna and Lydia, their flawless, pudgy faces often indistinguishable. She could usually find clues, however, that revealed their identities. John's mutton chop sideburns placed him solidly in the 1970s. The baby in his lap had to be Anna. "John, who's this?" she asked, holding up a picture of a baby. He looked up from the journal he'd been reading, slid his glasses down his nose, and squinted. "Is that Tom?" "Honey, she's in a pink onesie. It's Lydia." She checked the Kodak printed date on the back to be sure. May 29th, 1982. Lydia. "Oh," he said. He pushed his glasses back up onto the bridge of his nose and resumed reading. "John, I've been meaning to talk to you about Lydia's acting classes." He looked up, dog-eared the page, set the journal on the table, folded his glasses, and settled back in the chair. He knew this wouldn't be quick. "All right. I don't think we should be supporting her out there in any way, and I certainly don't think you should be paying for her classes behind my back." "I'm sorry, you're right. I meant to tell you, but then I got busy and forgot. You know how it gets. But I disagree with you on this. You know I do. We supported the other two." "That's different." "It's not. You just don't like what she picked." "It's not the acting. It's the not going to college. The window of time she's likely to ever go is rapidly closing, John, and you're making it easier for her to stay out." "She doesn't want to go to college." "I think she's just rebelling against who we are." "I don't think it has anything to do with what we want or don't want or who we are." "I want more for her." "She's working hard. She's excited and serious about what she's doing. She's happy. That's what we want for her." "It's our job to pass on our wisdom about life to our kids. I'm really afraid she's missing out on something essential. The exposure to different subjects, different ways of thinking, the challenges, opportunities, the people you meet. We met in college." "She's getting all that." "It's not the same." "So it's different. I think paying for her classes is more than fair. I'm sorry I didn't tell you, but you're hard to talk to about this. You don't ever budge." "Neither do you." He glanced at the clock on the fireplace mantel, reached for his glasses, and placed them on top of his head. "I've got to go to lab for about an hour, then I'll pick her up at the airport. You need anything while I'm out?" he asked as he stood to leave. "No." They locked eyes. "She's going to be fine, Allie. Don't worry." She raised her eyebrows but didn't say anything. What else could she say? They'd played the scene out together before, and this was how it ended. John argued the logical path of least resistance, always maintaining his status as the favorite parent, never convincing Alice to switch over to the popular side. And nothing she said swayed him. John left the house. Relaxed in his absence, she returned to the pictures in her lap. Her adorable children as babies, toddlers, teenagers. Where did the time go? She held the baby picture of Lydia that John had guessed was Tom. She felt a renewed and reassuring confidence in the strength of her memory. But of course, these pictures only opened the doors to histories housed in long-term memories. John Black's address would have lived in recent memory. Attention, rehearsal, elaboration, or emotional significance was needed if perceived information was to be pushed beyond the recent memory space into longer-term storage, else it would be quickly and naturally discarded with the passage of time. Focusing on Dr. Davis's questions and instructions had divided her attention and prevented her from rehearsing or elaborating on the address. And although his name elicited a bit of fear and anger now, the fictitious John Black had meant nothing to her in Dr. Davis's examining room. Under these circumstances, the average brain would be quite susceptible to forgetting. Then again, she didn't have an average brain.